everyone. Welcome back to the Fenscast, your podcast from Fens. And this week we're joined by Professor John Fox. John is the Killian and Caroline F. Schmidt Chair in Neuroscience at the University of Rochester, where he's Professor and Chair in the Department of Neuroscience. He moved to Rochester in 2015 after working in places like the Nathan Klein Institute in New York and also City College and Albert Einstein College of Medicine after originally studying in Dublin and UCD. In 2015, he also took over as initially co-editor-in-chief and in 2020, editor-in-chief of EJN, the official journal of FENS. And he's a prolific researcher who works in the area of neurophysiology, of neurological and psychiatric conditions, currently with a H-index of 100. So, John, you're very welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you here. Can I just ask you, first of all, how did you first get involved with EJN?
Well, Richard, thanks for having me and to talk about one of my favorite subjects, actually, EJN, which I'm, as you well know, I'm extremely passionate about. So how did I get first involved in EJN? You know, it was funny. It was, I remember being a graduate student, walking into the Society for Neuroscience meeting, probably back in the 1990s. And there was a booth set up. And Barry Everett, one of our former editors and a president of FENS and a president of the Society for Neuroscience, was there. And they had this truly lovely, glossy journal. And it had European Journal of Neuroscience on it. It was the first time I had seen that. And as a European in the United States, it really gave me a real buzz. I was like, oh, fantastic. We have one of our own. And you know, you'll remember the historical context too, right? You know, it was the early 1990s, and as an Irishman talking to an Irishman, you know, we were really joining the EU and the Maastricht Treaty and everything, and I was feeling a lot of personal pride in the European enterprise, and despite everything that's gone on politically in recent times, I'm still extraordinarily proud of Ireland's role in Europe. And so it was that kind of confluence of things. So one of the things I committed to do was, you know, to send one of my papers to the European Journal of Neuroscience. And so that was the start of it. And not to belabor the point, the other thing was that on the cover was this really beautiful painting. And it was a painting, as it turns out, I learned afterwards, that the very first editor of the European Journal of Neuroscience, the great Ray Guillory, who passed away just a couple of years back now, Ray had commissioned, and that painting graced the cover for the first few years of the journal's existence, and so it just looked great, frankly.
And do you know what happened to that painting, or who has it, or where it's gone?
Well, that's a great question. You know what happened was Paul Bolam and I. So I'll skip ahead to 2015, and Paul and I had taken over as the co-editors in chief. Paul's at Oxford. And we had a fantastic partnership, Paul and I, and we were very interested in sort of getting some of the history of EJN down. And so one of the first things we did was we actually commissioned an editorial from Ray to, you know, just talk about the early days and the genesis of the journal and how it came about. And Ray wrote a beautiful editorial. I highly encourage your listeners to go and have a read of it. It'll give you great insight into those early days of EJN. And then we went on a hunt for the front cover. And we, you know, of course, you know, we're now in the digital age. So, you know, the paper copies were long since gone. And we ended up finding one in the Bodleian. And so so the picture in that editorial is of Ray holding up the cover, that first cover of EJN. The original painting, I don't know where it is, was commissioned. It was a lady artist who did it. And of course, I don't remember her name, but it's in that editorial.
That would be a fantastic thing to try and track down. I think it'd be fabulous.
Wouldn't it, the original? It'd be great to have for Ben's history.
Yeah, exactly. So when you stepped in to take over as co-chair and then later editor-in-chief, what were the challenges that you faced in taking command of such a large journal?
So I'm going to go back to your previous question very quickly, just because, you know, of course, I sent my first paper there. And Then we, from my lab, we used to send a lot of papers to the European Journal of Neuroscience because, and this is key, and something that your listeners will want to know, because they were always extremely well, fastidiously handled. We would get reviews back. They were professional, polite, not ad hominem. And what was really clear was that the editors were controlling is the wrong word, but moderating the process, and that they were actively engaged. So many of your listeners will know, like, you know, you send your paper in and it's a little bit like a poll. You get some reviews back. The editor's not paying a whole lot of attention. They're just kind of adding up, you know, major, minor revisions and making the decision on that basis. And what was really clear at the European Journal of Neuroscience was that the editors were reading the reviews, working with the reviewers, and we would get these letters back from the section editor and the editor-in-chief that made it clear that our paper had gotten very, very serious consideration. So, and there's nothing better as a scientist than that, where you realize that the people in the journal are on your side. They're on your team. They're trying to make your paper better. So we always loved that about EJN. And my own lab was a big supporter of EJN. Two of the editors subsequently, Martin Sarter from the University of Michigan and Jean-Marc Fritzi from Switzerland, they brought me on as a section editor. And that's how my editorial sort of trajectory started. And I was very committed, so I was a section editor. And then ultimately in 2015, became the editor-in-chief with Paul. Now to your question, sorry. What happened was in 2015, there will be a history written of scientific publication, but, you know, we have gone through, 15 years of true upheaval in the field, right? We've had the online movement, the open access movement. We've had all of these journals come into the space. So, Richard, you're not as old as I am, but you'll remember, you're old enough to remember when the number of journals we could choose from was relatively limited. And it made life pretty straightforward. Today, God knows, 300, 400 different journals you could choose from. So EJN had been around since 1986 and was part of that, some of the earliest journals in the field. But, you know, between PLOS and Frontiers and the Nature behemoth, you know, there's a new journal every other day. And so the space is incredibly competitive. And it's a difficult space for the society journals, because society journals are not run by major corporations. And we don't have advertisement budgets and all the rest of the media machines to throw at this. So a lot of the society journals were in decline. And really, we were getting our lunch eaten, if you like, by these big commercial enterprises. And that was the challenge in 2015. It's like, how do you take a journal that's been around as long as EJN, that maybe is perceived as a little bit old school, fuddy-duddy was how Paul used to put it, and make it relevant to youngsters in the field, up-and-comers, who are, endlessly chasing glamour, high impact, as people would say, publications. Now, high impact, what does it mean, a high impact publication? What they really mean is getting in a glamour magazine. The high impact, the impact of your publication is the impact of your publication. It's whether it's good or not. And that will be, that story will be written over the course of time. So that was the challenge. Sorry.
No, that's fine. Because that leads me into the next question of what did you do to tackle those challenges and to change the perception and the profile of EJN?
Yeah. So the key is, I remember sitting with Paul and a lot of our section editors who were extremely committed and saying, well, how do we make ourselves relevant? One thing, of course, was to try to re-educate our community about the importance of society-owned journals. When folks supported EJN and FENS, EJN is the funding engine of FENS, that by submitting your paper to EJN, the proceeds would ultimately come back into the community, came to FENS to run workshops, to run our meetings, to keep the scientific enterprise afloat. So, we have a saying, EJN's a journal run by scientists, for scientists, to support the scientific enterprise. That is a very different model than what goes on in the commercial journals. The commercial journals, in the end of the day, your dollars, your euros, your rubles, whatever, are going to a commercial enterprise to pay shareholders, stockholders, and people. And I'm not saying anything against the basic commercial enterprise. They have every right to operate in the space. But what we wanted was our public to understand those two different financial models. So that was one major piece of it. And then the other is, and maybe much more important, is we needed to make EJN fresh and relevant. And we've done that by becoming politically relevant in the field, by running editorials, by innovating, by being the first journal to really introduce transparent peer review, reviewing mentorship scheme, by running editorials about young and up-and-coming scientists. We have a Woman in Science series that we've been running for many years. We're extremely active in the diversity and inclusion space. We were, obviously, you know, this has become highly thematic over the last 2 or 3 years, but EJN's been doing this now for a decade. And diversifying our board and on, just really consistently looking to be at the leading edge. And I think that that has taken hold with our community over time. It took a few years for people to realize that we were pushing hard on this front, but we now see it in the number of submissions and the number of papers in EJM, which has more than doubled over the last 5 years.
Yeah, the growth in the numbers at EJN has been really impressive. And you touched on diversity and inclusion, and that seems to be a real ethos behind EJN at the moment. Where did you start with that, or how did you begin with that journey?
If you had cast your eyes over the editorial boards of pretty much any journal in our field or any field 15 years ago, 10 years ago, it would have been, I don't even need to say it out loud, I call it the pale, male and frail crew. It would have been predominantly blokes, white ones, from the big countries, the big scientific engine countries, the US, the UK, Germany, and so on. And I'm painting in broad strokes here. I'm sure there are places out there that were working very hard. So Paul and I saw that immediately when we took over EJN. And I would say that EJN was better than most places. But we basically said this: we need to move towards a geographically diverse, that is, we represent 38, or the folks at FENS can correct me, but at last count, 38 nations and societies. And we represent the world neuroscience community. And so it's upon us to have editors that represent the world neuroscience community. And so that means from all corners of the globe, from every country, if we can help it, we should have an equal mix of people of each sex, and we should have gender diverse board, and we should have all colors, races, creeds as best we can represent. Now, obviously, you've got about 50 editors, so you can't cover every single base all the time. But that's so we set out on that journey. And I can tell you today that 45 or 46% of the board were just slightly tilted male to female, but we're very close to 50-50. And at last count, we had something like 28 different countries represented. I encourage your readers to go on our board on the website at EJN, and you will see that we are extremely diverse from a race and ethnic perspective. It's a long journey, but it's an attainable journey. And we were just talking about the increase in submissions. What came along with that was increase in submissions from all over the world. In a given year, I'll tell you, here's a specific number. In 2014, if I recall correctly, we had one submission from Australia, a country with a mighty research engine in the neurosciences. We have three Australian editors today, and we receive tens and tens of submissions each year from Australia. Why? Because we have Australian editors, and it became a legitimate place for people to come to. And that's just Australia. I could go down the list of countries that we now receive submissions from that we didn't in the past.
That's brilliant. And what sort of response have you received for those efforts, and what sort of feedback have you received from the community?
Well, it's the other place where we I think are particularly active, and maybe do better than the average bear out there, is in the social media space. And that's where we get a lot of feedback on Twitter and that. And over the years, you know, people have really started to comment on the fact that EJN is at the cutting edge, and that we have tried to be progressive, and people have noted the diversity of our folks. And we really promote our folks through those platforms. So that's one way. And certainly, you know, when I go to FENS Executive Council and that, you know, I've had presidents from the various societies, places, for example, that weren't well represented in the past, the smaller countries like our own, Richard, who say, oh, you know, EJN really sees us and FENS sees us. And I think that goes to the strength of this amazing community.
That's fantastic. And it's been a great job that you've done there. You mentioned a little bit earlier the editorials that you've really tried to promote, and there's a series of editorials coming up from FENS Kavli scholars. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what that will involve?
Absolutely. So the FENS Kavli network is a, you know, just so all the listeners understand, this is every 2 years is a coterie of very young, exciting youngsters from across Europe chosen to be FENS Kavli scholars, and it's a special program. And we've worked since the beginning of that program, EJN has worked closely with the FENS Kavli scholars and commissioned editorials from them about the kinds of challenges that they face. It'll be no surprise to most of the listeners that we all rail against and have difficulties with the way funding is done, with the publishing models, with the promotion models, with some of the, you know, anachronistic ways in which our universities work. You know, we're very proud of the fact that our universities are hundreds of years old, even 1,000 years old in some cases. But the fact that we're still operating under some of the premises that drove the foundation of our universities in 2022 doesn't always make a lot of sense. I mean, and, you know, again, many of these places, you know, have this sort of ivory tower. They were built by white wealthy people at a time, and so some of that stuff has hung in there. So we've asked this youth movement to help us envision a new future for neuroscience, to understand what it means, for example, you know, to put together a European neuroscience research perspective. What's it like to be a new PI setting up a lab? What are the hurdles and challenges? What's it like to be a minority person operating at a university where pretty much everybody's white around you, for example? All those kinds of things. And they've written some really hard-hitting editorials that tackle these issues. And that goes back to, you know, why is EJN now seen as a fresh place? Because we're not afraid to tackle those issues. We're not sitting on our hands over here. We want to be relevant, and we want to be, I don't want to say controversial, but as scientists, what are we if we're not asking the big, hard questions? And that's not just in the lab. It's also in terms of policy, you know, progressing and projecting the strongest possible research mission we can. So that's where those young folks have really, really helped us. You know, where are the good ideas going to come from? It's those folks. I'm too old and gnarled to really have fresh ideas. I'm here to help others get theirs out.
That sounds fantastic. And I think you're right. I think those ideals reflect the ethos of FENS as well, to be provocative and to ask those questions, and for there not to be sacred cows that we can't address and tackle. So what's next in terms of future editorials that are in the works after the contributions from the FENS Kavli scholars?
You know, we're always on the lookout, and I'll use this platform to make a call. If you have a burning issue, if there's something that's just been chewing you up for the last few years in the field, talk to us. We're open to it. We will help you get those ideas down on a page and get them out to the community. We have an editorial, for example, that's going to drop in the next week or two about the neuroscience of fake news. So I think people will find that very interesting. There was a fantastic seminar series or forum at the FENS meeting in Paris around that. And this is part of that, an editorial that comes from that effort to try to understand, like, you know, I mean, a pretty extraordinary modern phenomenon and to parse it into a historical context. We've run a lot of editorials around reproducibility and rigor, illustrating data in a reasonable way around data sharing, code sharing, to try to get at, you know, the reproducibility crisis that we're all aware of, and also to get at the part where we can try to break down the walls of the rich clubs. I mean, I keep mentioning this, you know, I've had the great good fortune of working in major institutions in the United States. So we have fantastic resources. And for me to generate data sets using high-end equipment is a relatively trivial thing. That is not true in the developing world. It's not true in whole parts of Asia and that. So we've been majorly part of the open science movement, and we've written a lot of editorials around this to make data available to people who can't produce it at their own universities. If they're a small teaching college, it's not just in the developing world. It's true here in the United States and in Europe too. If you're at a smaller technical college or that, where you don't have all those resources, how do you get your hands on high quality data so you too can progress a science agenda? So those are just some examples. And like I say, we're always looking for fresh new ideas.
Excellent. And since you took the role at EJN, what are the major changes or trends that you've seen in terms of the papers that are being submitted and coming in and landing on your desk?
You know, so what happens is, right, the papers follow the editorial board. This is something that I really learned when I took over at EJN. I don't think I was as aware of this as a scientist. But what people do is I'm sure people have their own idiosyncratic ways about choosing journals. But when they're trying to choose a journal, I think a lot of the time they're going to say, where are papers that I'm citing or relevant to the topic I'm working on? Where are they being published? That would be one. And where am I going to get well-treated? And where are there editors that will understand what it is I do? And they often go to look at the editorial board. And so what happens is, you know, if we have a major star in GLIA or astrocyte biology, we'll see more papers because that person's on the editorial board. And they go, oh, you know, Anya Majewska is on the editorial board in EJN. She'll know what to do with my paper on GLIA. And, you know, as the editor-in-chief, you know, I work in human neurophysiology and imaging and intellectual disability. So we got a lot of papers in that space because that guy Fox probably know what to do with this. Going back to this really important point I was making about having 50 editors that represent all fields and as many geographic locations and races and ethnicities, that has really increased our reach. It's increased the span of papers that we've gotten. We really, you know, European Journal of Neuroscience is a generalist journal. So we take papers across any aspect of neuroscience. When we do, another trick you should know about is when we notice that there's an area that's very active in the neurosciences that we might not be getting papers in, that they're going to one of our competitors, and we love a lot of our competitors, but we are competitors. We'll often commission a special issue in that area to announce ourselves in that area. So for example, you know, we were very interested in having more papers on animal models and in the intellectual disabilities and autism. So we had a special issue on autism that, you know, produced over 26, 27 papers. Before that special issue, we might get a couple of papers in that space every few months. Now we get a lot of papers. And I think what happens is, you know, if you do a special issue where a lot of the major leaders in the field put papers in there, it provides a runway for the rest of the field to go, oh, you know what? Those folks know what to do with these papers. So that's another way in which we sort of expand our portfolio.
Great. So do you have some special issues on the way that we should know about?
We do 6 special issues a year. That's what we aim for. We have 24 issues a year. So we try to have about a quarter of them be special issues. And we have a whole raft of special issues under development right now. And actually, again, go to the website. You'll always see the calls for paper there, and they go out across the social media world. We have a special issue right now on acetylcholine. We have a special issue on consciousness, which will be a new space for us. And we're wrapping on a special issue on sleep, although there's still a few weeks there. We have special issues on pain and schizophrenia that are in the pipeline right now. And of course, now the rest of them are escaping me. But I encourage people to go and look at the call for papers. It's right there on the website. And there's always a few open special issues. And then the other piece is check out the special issues that we've just produced, because some of them are absolutely spectacular, I should say. We have a really nice special issue on the neurobiology of Alzheimer's disease that will be released just in time for the upcoming Society for Neuroscience meeting. And that has a really fantastic raft of superb papers.
That sounds wonderful. And this has been really enlightening and informative, John. Let me ask you just finally, why should someone send their article to EJN in a nutshell?
Well, I mentioned it before, Richard. A very important driving philosophy for EJN is that we're not here to triage papers or action edited papers. We're a society owned journal run by scientists in that society. When people are submitting to EJN, you're submitting your paper to colleagues who know what it is to be in the lab and to be doing what it is you're doing when you're submitting the paper. And the way we see it is, as a society owned journal, it's our job to help you make your work as good as it possibly can be. And we set out with it's like the teacher who says, I'm starting off the year assuming everybody's getting an A. And that's how we do it. We want to see your paper published, and we want to see it published in the best possible format, as good as it possibly can be. And so we don't reject papers on the basis of like whatever the latest fad and fashion is. We are completely blind to, the institution that you're doing the work at, the country that you come from, whether the work is niche or not. We want just good, solid science, and we will do everything we can to get your paper across the finish line. And then you will receive very considered expert reviews that will help you make the work better. And you will receive input from a section editor, a senior editor, and the editor-in-chief. So at the very least, you'll have five sets of expert eyeballs on your work when it comes to EJN. And we do all that in a relatively rapid turnaround. We're typically back to people within just a little over a month. We're sort of hovering around 35 days to first decision at the moment.
That sounds absolutely ideal. This has been really enlightening and informative. Thanks so much, Professor John Fox, for joining us today.
Richard, thanks very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the FENSCast. Before you go, keep in mind that the countdown to the FENS Forum 2024 has started. Taking place from 25 to 29 June in Vienna, Austria, the next forum will be the perfect setting to meet and share ideas and knowledge, while also enjoying one of Europe's most iconic cities. Here are some key dates. The call for satellite and networking events will open on 13 September, and the call for early registration, abstract submission, and FENS travel grants will open on 29 November 2023. FENS is also delighted to announce that applications for the FENS Dana Brain Awareness Week 2024 grants will be open from 12 July until 14 August 2023. Don't forget also to send your nominations for the Chica and Heinz Schaller Foundation Award in Translational Neuroscience before the submission deadline on 19 July. The Brain Conference on Structuring Knowledge for Flexible Behavior, late registration, is open until 5 September. Don't miss the opportunity to attend this incredible neuroscience event. FENS continues to offer training opportunities for early career researchers, so apply for the FENS EBROPERC Exchange Fellowships and the FENS EBROPERC Stipends to attend a NENS course. Thank you for listening, and join us for the next episode of FENSCast. Don't forget to follow us on FENS.org, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, and YouTube.